Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
What's up, guys? Welcome to another episode of Bro History. It's Henry Zamota and Danny Abdeljabbar. What's up, brother? How are you?
Chilling, man, as per usual. And happy Halloween, dude.
How was Halloween in Puerto Rico compared to the United States?
Well, you are the United States.
Compared San Juan, to mainland U.S.
San Juan was all right. It's leaves something to be desired, but I, you know, given the fact that I couldn't find very much to do on the day that didn't cost like $300, that I thought it was going to be worse. So we went to a little area that I've taken you to a few times already, La Placita, which is this big, you know, open air bar area. And it was cool. We got like a 40% hit on people dressed up in costumes. And of course I was in the best costume because, you know, it's your boy. But
what did you do? What were you?
I was the devil again this year.
The devil.
Yeah, I have a really insane looking mask. It's got crazy giant teeth. Maybe I'll post it in Patreon for anyone who might be interested.
I don't think anyone's interested.
I don't know. I think they might be. We'll have to find out.
I think we're gonna find out that no one's interested. Were they yelling El Diablo?
Yeah, they were actually. Yeah, it was funny.
Oh,
yeah, they got
oh
a
boy.
Kick out of it. It was great.
Well, good for them, and good for you. I'm happy you had fun. So on today's episode, we are going to talk about World War
One. We're going to talk about history of Halloween.
No, we're not. We're going to talk about World War One. And
damn it,
we are. I guess it's kind of timely because, you know, I've noticed over the past years, there's been an interest or rising interest in learning about World War One and just in popular culture. And when I was younger, there really weren't any movies, there weren't any TV shows, there wasn't much besides your junior year like Western Civ course in high school that went over World War One or discussed it, and that was
for a week. Yeah,
that was for a week. And then, you know, most of that class was dominated by World War II.
Right.
Because World War II is the sexier story. Now, I've noticed that there's been an uptake in films about World War I.
Mm-hmm.
And so, games. Yeah, films. And I guess there was a video game that came out not so long ago.
Battlefield 1. That was all in World War I. It was super cool. And I think Call of Duty did one too. I just didn't play that one.
Well, in addition to video games, there's obviously been films. Mm-hmm. And the film, there was a movie, I think it really started with Peter Jackson. And Peter Jackson released basically just archive films. So he remastered and he colorized this old footage that he found and completely restored it to where it looks pretty amazing. I don't know if you've seen, I think it's called They Shall Not Grow Old. Have you heard of that?
I have, and I think I've seen clips on YouTube, but I've never watched the film itself.
It's very interesting. It's pretty amazing what he's able to do with this film, with this old, like, kind of grungy film, because they show you, the first half hour of this documentary is like the grungy, old, black and white, you know, silent film, and then all of a sudden he transitions it to color. And then he hires voice actors. He gets like the real weapons to sync them into the soldiers who are walking around. Mm-hmm. And he gets real weapons in the background. He syncs them in. It's honestly really remarkable what he does. And apparently he did this almost completely as a public service, where he didn't even, you know, take a paycheck for this. He just did it because he has a big passion for World War One and history.
Hmm.
So it was really interesting. Another film that came out, I think it was 1917, and I actually haven't seen this, where it has something to do, I think it's like one of those films where it's like shot, it's like one shot.
Yep, I saw it. It was awesome.
It was awesome? I haven't seen it, but I've heard good things. And now most recently there was the, I guess the new adaption of All Quiet on the Western Front,
mm-hmm.
which is of course like the German book that came out in, I think, 1930 or 1929. Came out in the late 20s, early 30s. And then there was a movie. I think the movie was American made and it won the Academy Award. And this movie was, you know, this book is a classic. I'm pretty sure I read this when I was either in college or high school. And, you know, it's a sad book. It's nothing really heroic about this story. It just really has to do with the horror of fighting in a trench from the German perspective.
Mm-hmm.
And Netflix, I think, I'm not sure who produced this or what studio produced this, but Netflix,
the German one,
at the very least, released it to an American audience. They just came out with like the new adaption, the 2022 version of All Quiet on the Western Front. And I have to say, it's very moving. And it's, you know, it definitely captures the same feeling that you get from the book, that it's impending doom, hopelessness. It's very sad. It's hard to watch at moments. What were your impressions of it? Because I know you just recently saw it.
I mean, you know, it was really good, as most of these films are. And I'm just kind of into this. So, you know, I had my girlfriend watching it for the first, I don't know, 20, 30 minutes, and she immediately walked away and started doing whatever it was that she was doing before I turned it on. So it's definitely like a war movie. You know, you have to be into that kind of stuff to appreciate it, I think. I guess some of my favorite parts were just like showing
the... And don't spoil anything. If someone hasn't read the book don't spoil like the ending or anything. I will say...
The Germans capitulate.
I will say the book, the new movie, it basically captures the same story. There are narrative differences, but the essence, like the two main characters, Paul and Kat, they basically, like, you know, go through the same story arc.
Right, exactly. And you know, I really like what they did with, you know, kind of showing what it was like in the trenches. I really like the bit where they're going around collecting the tags, because I think that whole motif of counting the dead was like a big kind of point to the story. It's like how many people are dying from this particular war. And obviously this is just a little microcosm of the war in general. You know, they end the story by telling you that like 17 or 20 million people, you know, died in this war. So, you know, it was pretty powerful, heavy shit. Definitely not something you want to watch if you're feeling glum, but very interesting watch.
I will say the film does an excellent job at really taking the anti-war position, because most war films, they, even if they do have an anti-war kind of bent, I always feel like they take the, you know, they always kind of romanticize war.
They glorify it a little
bit. This doesn't romanticize war whatsoever. The point is pretty clear that this is hell. Like, the way that people die is completely arbitrary. There's no romanticism. There's nothing heroic about it. It's just hell.
Yeah.
And that's it. And you really see, you know, from the beginning of the film, where they kind of show how excited Paul and his friends are, and how, you know, riled up they are by the nationalism and the grand speeches, and they think that, you know, they're on the verge of taking Paris, and it's, you know, at this point it's 1917 when the war is clearly in a very big stalemate, and the Germans are for all intents and purposes losing the war at this time. And, you know, he goes in there expecting to you know, essentially be like a knight in shining armor, and then the reality just like dumps on his head. And mm-hmm. It's just really interesting to see him kind of cope with that.
Yeah.
It's a great film. If you haven't seen it, watch it. It's on Netflix. It's very good. Keep it in the German language, because the acting is just so good. The acting is outstanding.
Yeah.
So I would recommend just reading the subtitles.
Yeah, it's worth it. It's definitely worth it.
We want to talk about World War One. I think that it's relevant again today, and I know we've talked and we've done episodes where we did like the origins of World War One or how World War One started, and we went through the politics and the geopolitics of that era. But I think it's about time to give it another shot and go over this history again, because it has been at least 2 years since we did a World War One episode.
Yeah,
I think it's been a while. And I want to just perhaps even take this into multiple episodes, because we've done the last World War One or Origins of World War One episode. I know it was probably like just one 90-minute episode rather than a real fleshed-out case study and journey of how this all happened. You know, the challenge that I usually have when looking at World War One and how it started is, where do you start? Where do you start this story where, you know, this war that kills 20 million people, where do you start? And then whose perspective do you look at this from? Because we're talking about over 10 different belligerent countries in this conflict. And, you know, all these countries have, you know, so many different motivations and circumstances and personalities who are moving pieces around. And because of that, I think it's important to look at things at a macro level. And then from that macro level, you can zoom down from there. For me, and I think most people, you know, the origins of World War One is usually very German or British centric. That's what most people will typically examine. Like, you know, how did Germany and Britain end up in a war together? What was the foreign policy of Germany? Which kind of ignited this conflict? And I generally take the same approach just because there's like the most literature on that. Mm-hmm. And I probably do it to a fault to some degree. So I'm gonna try to look at the different angles of different motivations, between the French and the Russians and the Serbs and the Italians and the Austrians. But going into this, I think the most important thing when you're looking at World War One or when you're reading about it or trying to understand it is to look at how the war started rather than why the war started. Because when you ask why, it usually assigns blame to a party. You know what I mean? Like when you ask why did they do this, you can usually answer why, or the human brain tends to be like, well, because they're evil.
Right. The good guys versus the bad guys.
Well, because they're bastards. That's why it happened.
Mm-hmm.
The how, you look at it more objectively and you say, okay, well, this policy led to that policy, and this reaction led to this reaction. This escalated to that. So I think looking at it in that perspective is the better way, and you kind of pull more truth than just saying, well, because Kaiser Wilhelm was a fucking crazy person.
Right.
Or
which he might have been.
Or the British were sleazy, lying bastards. Or again, the French were just, uptight, and they couldn't get over losing, territory to the Germans.
Also probably
Or the
true.
Russians were just imperial, and they wanted to take Constantinople, and they wanted to do, that's all those things are, true to a certain degree. But, looking at all these things and how they eventually kind of collide to really make a horrible start to the 20th century. Because this was the opening, the grand show of the 20th century is World War One, and it leads to World War II, of course, which is worse than World War One. And then
prequel, if you will.
Yeah, the prequel or the original. But both were catastrophic, apocalyptic events. They were World War One was basically a giant black hole that sucked the resources out of the world into mm-hmm. just nothing, into just chaos, and sucked human capital. It sucked investments. It destroyed Europe, morally, economically. It completely destroyed it to the point where the people who were living in Europe were living in such destitute that they looked to the communist and the fascist for answers.
Mm-hmm.
So it's an incredible, and when I say incredible, I just mean powerful thing to really look at. And I think it's worth understanding what were the main drivers behind the war. So I don't know, on this might be us kicking off a new series. because I really want to hit, you know, different aspects of this, because I think there's just so many different interesting stories in the overall narrative of how the war started that you can just take a lot out of it and learn. So where should I begin?
Maybe like in Jesus times. You could probably trace it that far back.
Well, I mean, I think the...
I'm kidding.
You can start anywhere, but I think the natural starting point is 1871.
Sure.
Because if you don't start at 1871, you can just go back to like the Roman conquest of Germania, or no, you can just go, there's no ending. You can go start at the 30-Year War or really whatever. You can start at the Napoleon's Wars in Germany. So 1871, the reason why we would start there is because that's when Germany unifies as one state. It's the year that Germany officially goes from, you know, a confederate realm of German princedoms to a unified state. Mm-hmm. Prior to the 19th century, 23 million Germans were divided into 314 states. So, you know, these states were loosely united under the nominal rule of the Holy Roman Emperor, who was also the Emperor of Austria.
I mean, 314, that's crazy. You know, when you think about just the size of the region that Germanic peoples would have been in and around, that's like splitting up a state into, like, I don't know, less than a county. Big city with its suburbs is like a state unto itself. That's crazy.
Yeah, just look at a map of the Holy Roman Empire in the 1600s, and it's just a bunch of little small towns, basically. It's you know, everything is autonomous. There's no centralized state. And when, you know, these wars kick off in the 1600s, these religious wars between Catholics and Protestants that evolve into, you know, a geopolitical struggle, there's no standing army. There's no professional armies. I mean, who are fighting on behalf of like one nation. Every single one of them is a mercenary. So it's just a completely, the concept of nation is not yet in existence. If you took one of these, and I know I use this term, I say this a lot, but I like this analogy. If you take somebody from this time period in 1633 and you put them in a time machine and then you put them in the United Nations, they would not know what the hell a nation was. They'd be like, what the hell is a nation? United Nation? Like, what? You mean like a council? Like a prince? Like, what the hell is a nation?
Right.
That concept of like this national unity would be completely lost on them. It does not really exist at this point in European history. So to make this more complicated, I mean, Germany is a pretty rough place to stick a nation state, as in it doesn't really have any natural frontiers, especially in the east and the south. Also, it wasn't really even possible to define Germany on ethnic grounds. The Holy Roman Empire, it included land with French and Dutch and Danish and Polish and Czech speakers. And then there was a lot of Germans who lived outside of the Holy Roman Empire as well. Now, there was one state that had real power, and that was Prussia. And
Russia.
Prussia, yeah. Prussia with a P in front of it. And Prussia loses a war to Napoleon in 1805. You know, what happens because of that loss is that the Holy Roman Empire completely just falls apart. And when the Holy Roman Empire disintegrates, Napoleon reorganizes all these little micro states essentially into larger states. And, you know, he also annexed territory on the left bank of the Rhine, and he combined states together. In effect, what Napoleon does, he kind of lays the groundwork for an eventual German state to exist. Now, when Napoleon falls, the structure that he created to rule German lands, it turns into a German confederation.
So let me get this straight. Are you saying that the modern German nation state is like a French invention then?
I wouldn't say it's a French invention, but I would say that the political reorganizing that Napoleon did in the former states that, you know, were included in the Holy Roman Empire that really didn't have any political power or much political power as, you know, as a collective empire at all, that his reorganizing sets the groundwork for a lot of this, for a lot of these states to be more unified at the very least.
So Napoleon's responsible for World War One, is what you're saying?
Yeah, you can say that. You can say that as a direct. I mean, in a lot of ways, you could trace Napoleon's influence to basically everything. The guy had an insane impact on global affairs, you know, to say the very least. But to pull this back, in response to losing to the French back in 1805, Prussia starts to make reforms to increase the power of the state. So, you know, reforms that would centralize government. You know, they created a professional army. You know, they have a mass education. Now, fast forward, and I'm going to be skipping through a lot of the different nationalist movements and revolutions and revolts that kind of solidify, you know, German nationalism. King Wilhelm I of Prussia, he selects a guy by the name of Otto von Bismarck to be his prime minister. And Bismarck comes from the Junker class in Prussia, which is the landowning class. His main prerogative, you know, as the most powerful statesman in Germany, was to increase the power of the Prussian royal family. And basically what he does is in, you know, the 1860s, he engineers a series of wars against Denmark, Austria, and France. And the goal, you know, behind these wars was to align the smaller German states behind them, effectively solidifying one German state dominated by the Prussian Junkers. With one caveat, though. He deliberately excluded the German-speaking Austrians because, you know, the Austrians already had Franz Joseph, who had been emperor for like 1,000 years.
He was
in his 70s or 80s at the time, but right. More like 50 years. I'm exaggerating, of course.
I guess the point was that they didn't want to share rulership with the Austrians because they already had a pretty structured governing body under Franz Joseph.
Exactly. The new state was going to be dominated by the Prussian ruling class, not the Austrians, not the Habsburgs. So there you go. Like, they were excluded from that initial alliance. And, you know, during the creation, they fought, you know, wars with each other. Now, the final step in creating Germany was the Franco-Prussian War, where, and I'm no expert on this part of German unification. So, I'm just taking kind of what a consensus is from a lot of historians, but what they'll say is that Bismarck actually goes, he goads the French into attacking the left bank of the Rhine in order for him to get support from the southern German states. And this outcome is that Prussia wins. They annex about 6,500 square miles of eastern France, Alsace-Lorraine, and the Prussian king Wilhelm I becomes the emperor of Germany.
Cool story, bro.
Yeah. And, you know, there's obviously a lot more to the history of the unification of Germany, but for time's sake, you know, there's a quick crash course. Now, the new German Empire, as strong as it is, it's surrounded by other countries that have an axe to grind with them. In the West, you have the pissed off France, who wants revenge, you know, for annexing territory. Then you also have the Russians and the Austrians to the east. Therefore, Bismarck, he has two major foreign policy goals. And the first goal was to isolate France from other allies in Europe and also encourage them to expand their empire in Africa. And the goal there was, you know, not only to distract them, but potentially get them into a conflict with the British, who were also in the empire business. The second major goal is to stabilize the relationship between Austria-Hungary and Russia. He didn't want them fighting, because if they're rivals, it could force Germany into a situation where they had to choose between, you know, one of the two. And if they favored one, it would leave the door open for the French to make an alliance with, you know, whomever they did not favor. So, you know, Bismarck, he creates an alliance called the League of Three Emperors. However, it wasn't really that effective of an alliance. The only thing that they really agree on is being hard on, like, democratic and you know, socialist Marxist movements. And to be honest, in the late 1800s, these socialist movements really don't have any power yet. Mm. This isn't, you know, 1917. This isn't the time where these socialist movements are threatening to take down states. So, I guess the big problem with the German, you know, the German Empire's eastern flank was that Austria-Hungary and Russia, they had conflicting interests in the Balkans. And, you know, the Balkans was basically Ukraine of the Ukraine of that era in terms of just being a hotspot. Everyone knew this, you know, before World War One broke out. Even like the poor blacksmith's son knew this, that this was, you know, a potential breaking point. If something happened, it could drag a lot of different countries into a war. But to pull this back to, you know, what's going on in the 1870s, the Ottomans were falling apart. And the Ottomans were falling apart really fast. So you have the Russians in Austria-Hungary trying to fill that power vacuum. And in the Balkans, there were a large number of Eastern Orthodox Slavs who were pulling at the heartstrings of the Russians, you know, based on common religion and heritage. And, you know, they were appealing to Russia in order to get them to assist in their historic struggle against the Muslim Turks. So this was a time of Pan-Slavism, and, you know, there was this really strong camaraderie between, you know, the Russians and the South Slavs, just like there is now. You know, you ever hear the saying that the most hardcore Russian nationalist on the internet is always a Serb?
Yeah, I do. This is why.
I mean, it goes back to this, but, you know, it goes back to... It goes back to like this shared, you know, Pan-Slavism and these nationalist movements. And, you know, in modern times, a breaking point between U.S. and Russian relations was when NATO bombed Serbia. A lot of Russians were very upset about that, but I digress. So the Russian Empire had been involved in some way or another in Serbian politics for decades at this point. So they were doing things like aiding Serbian resistance movements. You know, they were representing them in international councils. They were called Serbia's big brother. In Serbia, what was going on at that time, and I think this will warrant a different episode. We've talked about this before, and I think we even have even done episodes on this, but such a crazy story. In Serbia at this time, there was these two families that were going back and forth in controlling essentially the Serbian throne, which started off as a vassal state to the Ottoman Empire, but they eventually get their independence. There were these two families and two factions that were going back and forth for about 100 years who were just constantly just killing each other. There was a very strong or bitter rivalry between these two families fighting for the throne of Serbia. And you know, one of the big things is that they were aligning with different, you know, one aligned with the Austrians, one aligned with the Russians. To pull this back, in the 1870s, there was a widespread revolt against the Ottoman Empire, and it was all across the Balkans. And Russia is backing the rebels. However, Austria-Hungary doesn't want the Ottoman Empire to fall. They want the Ottomans to stick around because what they're actually worried about is not necessarily like another great power. They're more worried about the Serbs because they think the Serbs are crazy. And the last thing they want is an aggressive Serbian state on their border. Mm. So I'm going to pull a quote from the Austro-Hungarian foreign minister in 1875. Maybe you can read this so I can take a glass of water.
Yeah, sure. Turkey possesses a utility almost providential for Austria-Hungary, for Turkey maintains the status quo of the small Balkan states and impedes their aspirations. If it were not for Turkey, all of these aspirations would fall down on our heads. If Bosnia-Herzegovina should go to Serbia or Montenegro, or if a new state should be formed there, which we cannot prevent, then we should be ruined and should find ourselves assume the role of sick man.
Hmm.
Interesting.
Look, Bumble knows you're exhausted by dating. All the, must not take yourself too seriously, and 6-1 since that matters, and what do I even say other than, hey? Well, that's why they're introducing an all-new Bumble, with exciting features to make compatibility easier, starting the chat better, and dating safer. They've changed, so you don't have to. Download the new Bumble now.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Assume the role of sick man is an odd to the Ottomans, because in the late 1800s, ever since the Crimean War, the Ottoman Empire was called the sick man of Europe.
Why? Because they were
saying that if there's a state, if there's a Serbian state, then we're going to become the new sick man of Europe. Like, that's how big of a catastrophe it will be to Austria-Hungary's pristine across other world powers. And because the last thing that they want is a Yugoslavia type state of, you know, united Southern Slavs appearing on their borders, and appearing on their border dominated by radical Serbs, because Austria-Hungary is an empire with a sizable Orthodox Slav population. What they feared a Serbian state would encourage other ethnic groups to, you know, one, you know, join the Serbs or create their own independent state. So they were very nervous about what would be the result of a Serbian state with very hard nationalist sentiment.
Right. And this, friends, is why borders are bullshit, because the Austrian Empire housed quite the amount of, as you put it, Orthodox Slavs. So really didn't make.
Yeah, and it's just, I mean, Austria-Hungary was dominated by German and Hungarian speakers, but they weren't the majority. They had Czech speakers and Serbs and Polish speakers. Mm-hmm. They had about something like 12 or 13 official languages, at least 12 or 13 languages where each that consisted of more than like 3% of the country. I don't know what the exact stat is, but the point is, it was a lot. There was a lot of languages. It was a multicultural society. The Germans were by no mean the majority in Austria-Hungary. But right. I guess the ultimate point I'm trying to make here is not necessarily what was going on in the empire of Austria-Hungary. It's more so is that Russia and Austria had contradicting Balkans policies. Thus, it made them geopolitical rivals. And for Bismarck, this becomes a really difficult juggling act, trying to keep both of these states happy. Because again, the German policy is to have these guys get along, not be rivals. Because who cares about the Balkans? And, you know, in the eyes of Germany.
Right.
It doesn't border Germany. Like, why do they care? Like, they don't really give a shit what's going on there. Bismarck, he has a quote. He says that the Balkan question was not worth the healthy bones of one Pomeranian musketeer.
I know Pomeranian is like a type of person, but I'm thinking of like the dog that's a musketeer.
Yeah, that's also the vision that creeps up in my head. Some doofy dog with a sword and a musket.
Yeah.
But, you know, nevertheless, they do ultimately side more with Austria-Hungary. And in 1877, Russia, with an alliance with, you know, the southern Slavs, mainly the Serbs and the Balkans, they go to war with the Ottomans, and they basically knock the Ottomans out of Europe. They push them back to Istanbul. And, you know, Romania, Serbia, Montenegro, they all get independence from the Ottoman Empire. But the problem is now is that, you know, at least for the great powers, they need to intervene and try to figure out what are the rules now. Like, who's going to, what's the deal with, like, sphere of influence politics? Because the Ottoman Empire had been dominating this part of the world for, at this point, like 400 years. So who gets what, and who is going to be the most, you know, what are going to be the geopolitical rules in terms of who has power here, who's filling the vacuum of the Ottomans? And that's what ultimately creates so much friction in the Balkans, why it becomes this hotspot. So what's decided, in the way that Bismarck plays this, in Germany's eyes and in Bismarck's eyes, he sees this as an opportunity to kind of put their stamp as like, oh, Germany is this neutral player. We, you know, we're able to, you know, mitigate potential hotspots. We're able to be unbiased mediators. I don't know why I couldn't think of that word. We could be mediators in these global affairs. Look at this new German society. We're stepping up and, you know, we're stabilizing regions. So the Congress of Berlin, what's ultimately decided is that Austria-Hungary would get Bosnia and Herzegovina and some other territories. And then Russia ended up getting ports and stuff, essentially, on the Black Sea. They got, like, some, I forget exactly, but mainly it was ports in the Black Sea. So that was the exchange. And, you know, a lot of people weren't happy about what took place. A lot of people wanted Russia to take a larger sphere of influence in Bosnia and other places. And so it caused a lot of problems. For Bismarck, though, this was, you know, not even really a long-term solution, because what the ultimate fear was in German policy was that, you know, the Austrians would enter an alliance with France. That was the last thing that they wanted. So because of this fear, in 1879, Bismarck enters into an alliance with Austria-Hungary. And the thinking was that if he joined a defensive alliance with Austria-Hungary, Russia would have to work with them. Because Russia, if they got into a war, it's not like Russia could fight both at the same time. Like, Russia wouldn't be able to fight Germany and Austria-Hungary all at once by themselves. So they were kind of forced to work with them. That was the thinking behind, German, mainly Bismarck. Ultimately, their main goal was keep Austria-Hungary from entering an alliance with France. We can't have that. That would be a catastrophe for us. So the next time there's a, you know, the League of Emperors, the League of Three Emperors meet, Germany, Austria, and Russia, they make a pledge of neutrality. So basically what they agree on, if one of them gets into a war with a fourth power, and the fourth power is France, it's not said in like the documents, but it is 100% France they're talking about. So if one of them gets into a war with France, no nation in the League of Three Emperors will join France's side. So they make a pledge of neutrality where if they get into a war with France, if Germany gets into a war with France, Russia nor Austria-Hungary will, you know, join that side. That was basically the arrangement. That's what That's what it essentially meant, because Austria-Hungary and France and Russia, there's things that they agreed on, but they also had, you know, potential rivalries with France as well.
So was this in terms of,
especially in Russia's case,
was this like a mutually agreed upon like neutrality thing, or did the Germans bring this up? Like, whose idea was this?
Germany was a primary pusher of the League of Three Emperors, so and I mean that was their prerogative, was to keep these, was ultimately to make sure that the situation was stable in the East. What he also tried to do is that he tried to bring Italy into the fold as well, because Italy had imperial rivalries with France. You know, they had been pushed out of North Africa by the French, so the Italians were looking to stick it to them. And the agreement that was made was Germany and Austria would come to Italy's assistance if they were attacked by France unprovoked. So in turn, Italy would assist Germany in a potential war against France. And you know, if a war broke out between Austria-Hungary and Russia, the agreement was that Italy would remain neutral. So this is the Triple Alliance. At the same time, France was encouraged to pursue empire building in Africa. And, you know, like I said earlier, the goal was to potentially get them into a conflict with the British, which does actually happen. I mean, there's a lot of different spots where they had conflicting policies on, but the most notable being the Suez Canal in Egypt. Because in 1882, there's this nationalist uprising in Egypt, and, you know, let's just say that this uprising was threatening bondholders with investments in Egypt. I don't know the entire story on this, but I do know that the British and the French, they were supposed to create an occupation zone in Egypt together, but for some reason or another, and I don't know the reason why, the French bailed, or at least that's what the British say, the French bailed on them, and the British were forced to lead the occupation on their own, and that's what leads to essentially the French losing the Suez Canal and the British establishing Egypt as a British protectorate. Bismarck was basically whispering in the ears of the French and saying, hey man, you got ripped off, because, you know, the French built the Suez Canal. So he encouraged France to, you know, look for compensation in other parts of Africa. You know, he would also kind of play this weird game diplomatically with the British colonies, where, you know, he would lay claims to places like Southwest Africa or the Cameroons. And he did this to create this colonial understanding with the French that, to some degree, Germany would undermine British influence. You know, as long as you guys didn't start claiming territory in Germany. He was trying to make the French okay with accepting a status downgrade in Europe by compensating them with an overseas empire, which he personally was not interested in. So his number one priority was German security and dominating continental Europe. And the alliance system started to broaden in 1887. The British and the Italians, they were cooperating in the Mediterranean. They started working together. That same year, the Triple Alliance was renewed between Italy, Germany, and Austria-Hungary. And then also Germany had signed a new agreement in which with Russia, in which they would remain neutral if a war broke out. So for the most part, Bismarck, at least when he was in power, he was able to stabilize things. But I guess the position that, in what a lot of historians will say about what Bismarck set up, is that it was overly complicated for any successor to pull off. Especially, yeah, if one was just not as competent as him, which is the case.
He struck too many deals with too many people.
Yeah, and a lot of these deals are like in his head, you know, like,
right.
So he did achieve short-term stability in Europe. But you can argue very strongly that Bismarck, he ended up ultimately creating long-term problems for his successors, because the biggest problem was, and there was really nothing that anyone could do about this, or no alliance that Bismarck could set or create, or, you know, no amount of imperial possessions that he would endorse for the French. Because remember, one of the disadvantages of Germany at this time is that, since that they're a continental power, they're not an overseas power, they can't compensate France. They can't give France like their own colonies. They can't be like, okay, we're sorry about that, why don't you take Libya?
Right.
Or we'll give you, you know, some of these islands. Germany doesn't really have imperial possessions, so they don't really have anything to barter with them or give them. They have to result in creating these alliance systems. They have to make these like really complex network of diplomatic solutions in order to kind of stay in front of France and ultimately keep them isolated from wanting to get the idea of, you know, trying to retake any claimed territory. So there was nothing that they could do that would change the attitude in France, that they were humiliated by the Prussians. And Bismarck, leaning towards Austria-Hungary over Russia, was eventually going to push Russia into the arms of the French. So I have a quote from Christopher Clark from the book Sleepwalkers.
Let me take
and Danny,
this.
Maybe you can take this.
All right, so the primary aim of German foreign policy in the Bismarck era was to prevent the emergence of a hostile coalition of great powers. For as long as it continued, the tension between the world empires made this objective relatively easy to accomplish. French rivalry with Britain intermittently distracted Paris from its hostility towards Germany. Russia's hostility to Britain deflected Russian attention from the Balkans and thus helped to stave off the Austro-Russian clash. As a mainly continental power, Germany, so long as it did not itself aspire to found a global empire, could stay out of the great struggles over Africa, Central Asia, and China. And as long as Britain, France, and Russia remained imperial rivals, Berlin would always be able to play the margins between them. This state of affairs enhanced the empire's security and created a certain wiggle room for policymakers in Berlin. But the Bismarck strategy also exacted a cost. It required that Germany always punch under its weight, abstain from the imperial feeding frenzies in Africa, Asia, and elsewhere, and remain on the sidelines when other powers quarreled over global power shares. It also required that Berlin enter into contradictory commitments to neighboring powers. The consequence was a sense of national paralysis that played badly with the electors whose votes determined the composition of the German national parliament. The idea of colonial possessions, imagined as El Dorados with cheap labor and raw materials and burgeoning native or settler populations to buy national exports, was as bewitching to the German middle classes as to those of the established European empires. That's super interesting. So it kind of points out the double-edged sword there, right? So on the one hand, you know, by not getting involved overseas, they're not inadvertently entering into hostilities with other empires. They're, you know, vying for global empires. But at the same time, they get stuck, right? They can only really play within the bounds of Europe. And in order to make that work, you know, he writes that they have to enter into contradictory commitments with neighboring powers. As you were reading a few of them before, I was actually starting to question, like, wait, I thought they were supposed to be neutral in this one and not neutral in that one and the other. It's like super hard to follow, so I can see how that could be a problem.
Well, yeah, I mean, just think about all the different alliances that they have set up at this point. So there's a triple alliance with Italy, Austria-Hungary, in Germany, and then there is an alliance between, there's a neutrality alliance between
the three empires.
There's also an alliance between, there's cooperation with the British and the Italians in regards to like Mediterranean shipping rights and trade routes and those types of things. So there's all these different systems in place right now, but they also contradict each other as well, because the elephant in the room is there's a couple of big contradictions. One being that the major one is obviously the Balkans ones. I mean, that's the one that eventually blows up and just causes a massive that sparks the powder keg. But there's also the problems with Britain. So one of the things that or one of the ways that Bismarck's Africa policy blows up in his face, or Germany's face eventually, it creates this mutual, instead of creating this this understanding with the French against the British, what it ultimately does, it gave the German public the false impression that their colonial ambitions were thwarted by the British.
Made them look weak.
So the German public, Germany are, like, just look at the politics of this era. So Germany is like the best nation in the world right now. They just united. They're a powerhouse. And there was a very strong appetite for worldwide influence. Like, why don't we have any colonies? Why don't we own half the world? Because at this point, the British and the French, they basically had colonies everywhere. Their populations together were, man, like something like 500 million people. They rolled over. It was something crazy. I mean, with Britain and India and the big population centers that they governed, and then they just governed a humongous amount of people and natural resources across the world. This was something that the German public was like, what's the deal? Like, we're this great country. Why don't we have this worldwide influence? Why isn't the world speaking German? Why is every single part of the world now speaking either English or French? So I think they looked at Britain as like the imperial enemy, and that's ultimately what Kaiser Wilhelm II, that's his attitude, and why he plays this game that kind of provokes a lot of animosity from the British later on, which I think we're going to save for another episode, like the British rivalry with the Germans, the naval race. But Bismarck is playing this colonial game for diplomatic reasons rather than this actual desire to control parts of Africa. Because remember, Bismarck, in Kaiser Wilhelm I, so Wilhelm II's father, they care a lot more about the junker class at the end of the day, dominating German domestic politics in continental Europe. I think Bismarck's had some quote along the lines of, when I look at a map of Africa, I see Germany, France, and Austria-Hungary and Russia, like, all surrounding Germany. That's what he says. Like, he doesn't, meaning that he doesn't care. It's none of his concern, really. Like, he cares about the national security, like, the direct national security interest of Germany. And then also, Germany is already an economic powerhouse at this time. So after unification in 1871, Germany immediately becomes the most powerful state in Europe, which completely tosses the European power dynamic for a loop. So between 1870 and 1914, the population jumps from 41 million to 66 million. So 40% of the population worked in Germany's industrial sector.
That's crazy.
Coal production had increased 800%. So more electricity was produced in Germany than Britain, Italy, and France combined. The same thing with steel production. So they produced 2/3 of Europe's steel. So greater than Britain, Italy, France combined.
And they were exporting it, I imagine.
Yeah. And this, you know, this dramatic expansion, it just freaked everyone out, especially the French. And to add insult to injury, much of Germany's industrial growth is due to the iron ore deposits found in Alsace-Lorraine. And, you know, going back to Alsace-Lorraine, and, you know, I think this is definitely the one of the major reasons for the war is you know, annexing territory. It could really blow back. There's a lot of blowback to annexing territory, and you see this in every single major war. Every world war, there's payback for annexed territory or territory mm-hmm. that is unjust. There's payback for this unjust feeling of having territory ripped from you, having your native speakers ripped for you.
Cue Ukraine and Crimea.
Yeah, sure. There's Ukraine and Crimea, and in the modern day, there's Germany in World War II. There's too many examples to really count. Annexing territory always creates long-term animosity towards one state from another. And Alsace-Lorraine, it wasn't just some territory in France. It was the center of Charlemagne's empire, his Frankish empire in the 9th century.
Also known as Karl der Große for Germans.
Karl der Große's empire.
Yeah, everyone always refers to him as Charlemagne, and it gives the impression that he's like just French side, you know? French guy, Charlemagne.
Well, I know French and Germans, they argue over what he was.
Yeah, they do.
No, he's German.
He's both. They both claim
he's
him.
French. So.
He was super important. Like very huge. He unified Europe in the 9th century, really.
He brought Christianity to those godless pagans.
Yep.
So that's where his empire, the center of his empire was, in Alsace-Lorraine. And then also, Alsace-Lorraine was a big part of the Holy Roman Empire until the end of the 30-Year War. It was politically impossible for any French government after 1871 to renounce the pursuit of taking back you know, this province. Just like how I imagine, and I think I said in our last episode, I think it's politically impossible for Zelensky to go back on any of the things that he has said.
Right.
I don't think it would be possible for a Ukrainian government at this point to not lay claims to any territory that they've lost over the past 5 years, including Crimea and, right. you know, the four provinces that they've lost
recently,
you know,
Luhansk
and Donetsk and Kherson and Zaporizhia. I'm just horrible pronouncing it, but those four provinces. Okay, where was I? Yeah, France is pissed off. There was nothing you could do. There was no political dancing around that you could do to settle their thirst for revenge for annexing territory. And then I have another quote from Christopher Clark, and I'll take this. Alsace-Lorraine became the holy grail of the French cult of revanche, providing the focus for successive waves of chauvinist agitation. The lost provinces were never the sole driving force behind French policy, yet they periodically inflamed public opinion and exerted a stealthy pressure on the policymakers in Paris. Even without the annexation, however, the very existence of the German Empire would have transformed the relationship with France whose security had traditionally been underwritten by the political fragmentation of German Europe. After 1871, France was bound to seek every possible opportunity to contain the new and formidable power on its eastern border. A lasting enmity between France and Germany was thus to some extent programmed into the European international system. It is hard to overstate the world's historical impact of this transformation. Relations among the European states would henceforth be driven by the new and unfamiliar dynamic. So the polarization of Europe is more than I think even the Balkans. And Sleepwalkers, this book is a really great. If you want to read a book about the polarization of like the alliance system, and also the crisis in Serbia, I think this is a great book to read. This is really good. It doesn't go as much into the British. There's other books I think that do a better job talking about the naval race between the British and the Germans that takes place, which is a huge factor as well. But this covers it, very thorough. The French-German dynamic.
Hey there, I'm Dylan Lewis, one of the hosts of Motley Fool Money. Each weekday on Motley Fool Money, we talk through the business news you need to know and the stories moving stocks on Wall Street. On weekends, we dive into the industries shaping tomorrow and host the experts, authors, and executives that understand them. Tune in for insights, a long-term perspective on investing, and of course, stock ideas, plenty of them. To quote a listener, it pays to listen. Check us out and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.
Want to learn how you can make smarter decisions with your money? Well, I've got the podcast for you. I'm Sean Piles, and I host NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast. On our show, we help listeners like you make the most of your finances. I sit down with NerdWallet's team of nerds, personal finance experts in credit cards, banking, investing, and more. We answer your real-world money questions and break down the latest personal finance news. The nerds will give you the clarity you need by cutting through the clutter and misinformation in today's world of personal finance. We don't promote get-rich-quick schemes or hype unrealistic side hustles. Instead, we offer practical knowledge that you can apply in your everyday life. You'll learn about strategies to help you build your wealth, invest wisely, shop for financial products, and plan for major life events. And you'll walk away with the confidence you need to ensure that your money is always working as hard as you are. So turn to the nerds to answer your real-world money questions and get insights that can help you make the smartest financial decisions for your life. Listen to NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
I think this is kind of the primary driver of the war. Because, it's so hard because there's so many primary drivers of the war that it's really almost a crime to just pick one of them. But this dynamic was just always going to lead to this this policy that would entangle all these different states into these weird alliance systems, the annexation of Alsace-Lorraine, and the French desire to not only just get back their territory, but not to become a second-rate power. That was ultimately the fear. You lose a territory, all right, it sucks, but this is 19th century Europe. People lose territories. It's not totally foreign that people lose parts, chunks of their state.
Mm-hmm.
It's the threat that they are going to be these second-class citizens in Europe compared to the German neighbors who are just crushing it economically. They're just crushing it in militarily. They're on their way. They're like new money, and then the French and the British and the Russians, they're the old money. And the old money don't look kindly to new money in a lot of cases. Like, who the hell are they? Germany used to be the backwater, a bunch of rival country folk, and now there's some superpower. It's not supposed to be like this. We're supposed to dominate politics there. We're the 30-year war was a war that was, you had all these larger powers that were essentially running proxy wars there. Well, imagine if, like, the center where you're having all these proxy wars unifies, and
be like, you know, as if the Middle East one day just decided to completely unify into, I don't know, let's call it a caliphate, and yeah.
And but then like became a like an that was
an economic powerhouse,
an economic powerhouse,
right?
And started building nukes,
right? Exactly. Everybody would freak out.
When there was a threat of that happening, and it wasn't under a caliphate, it was under Arab nationalism in the 1950s, right. There was the fear that Nasser was going to, because they had Egypt had formed a state, a very short-lived state that only lasted for 2 years with Syria.
Mm-hmm.
And they thought that, you know, this could actually, this could join together with Iraq and create this Arab state that would eventually be able to take out Saudi Arabia, and they would be able to control, you know, a very large disproportionate percentage of the world's oil resources.
Right.
So that was one of the reasons, and that was the primary reason why the U.S. policy was so hostile towards Arab nationalism, because they didn't, I mean, the last thing they wanted was this large Arab state that was independent. From,
they studied their history with Germany, you know?
Yeah. They studied their history with Germany, and they saw the potential threat, or what happens when common language speakers, maybe with different dialects in some parts of the country, unite. Because that's basically, you know, what the Arab world is. They're all speaking Arab. They have different dialects in different, you know, parts of the Arab world. But, yeah, I mean, it was just like a shock. It was a shock to the system, and it wasn't right. supposed to be this way. So, of course, there was, you know, besides the annexing territory, there was just this fear that their place in power was going to be pulled away from them by this new state. So, okay, I don't want to reiterate myself again. So what Bismarck ultimately was trying to do, what he did do can only work with someone like him in charge. So again, like another person wasn't going to be able to manage these different systems that he created. And, you know, his successor lacks the diplomatic skills necessary to, you know, continue this policy of French containment, which officially ends when France enters into a military alliance with Russia in 1893. And not only do they enter a military alliance, Russia and France, but they enter it into an economic partnership where, you know, France is initially, essentially, you know, putting a large percentage of their foreign capital into the Russian industrial sector and railroads. In Russia has a population of like 140 million people. France's population is stagnated. So there was this major fear on the German side. There is this fear of Russia becoming the new Germany, essentially, where once they industrialize, they have the human resource. They have the human capital along with the natural resources to surpass Germany. Because, I mean, essentially they do. I mean, just look at modern day Russia today. Russia is among the most resource-rich countries in the entire world. And
maybe
it's how...
the most industrious, though. Not like the Germans.
Yeah, I mean, they're not the most... They're not exporting, you know, machinery like the Germans are, but they do have just an almost unlimited amount of natural resources.
Right.
Energy and timber.
I do have a question because he kind of like ran over this. Why does Russia enter a alliance with France? Because like whatever happened, what'd you call it? The three empires treaty where they're all like going to be, you know, neutral or whatever. Like, how does this happen out of nowhere?
So the way that this happens is that Russia is... So it doesn't make any sense, really, on paper, because France and Russia aren't necessarily natural allies. Like, you wouldn't think of them as natural allies. They're both imperial powers.
They're on the other sides of Europe.
Yeah, on other sides of Europe. So Russia, they have a greater influence in Central Asia and the Balkans region. France, you know, a lot of their imperial power is in Northern Africa. So, you know, they can't help each other out. I guess there are some conflicting imperial policies that they have where, I think mostly in Turkey, where I don't think France allows Russia to ship through the Turkish Straits. I'm not sure, but I know that there's some conflicting imperial, conflicting policies which would serve to separate them. But I think there's some things that they do have in common which would unite them. So first and foremost, they both are rivals with the British in different areas of the world. So the Russians are rivals with the British in Central Asia, and they spend an entire century basically trying to outgame each other, in Afghanistan and in India, the great game. And then the French and the British are rivals in Africa. So, you know, there is that kind of mutual rivalry even outside of Germany with them. Then there is there's the economic reasons as well. So the French were investing a lot of money into Russia. But I think another thing was that Germany was also building up their army. And I think it came to the point where the Russians were just threatened by not just them building up their army, but Bismarck, he's fired in 1890. He's fired, I think, in 1890. And the guy, Kaiser Wilhelm II, didn't want him around. One of the reasons why Kaiser Wilhelm gets rid of Bismarck is, Bismarck is like a really old man at this time, so that could have been one of the reasons. But another reason is because Kaiser Wilhelm was one of those Germans who was like, hey, why doesn't Germany have a world influence? Like, why are we why do these overrated powers have all these overseas colonies? So he, you know, was the opposite of Bismarck, where he was Eurocentric and wanted to extend German power across the world. So I think that Russia started to view the Germans as a threat, and they both were really worried about the possibility of the British joining the Triple Alliance with Germany, Austria, Hungary, and Italy. And I think if that happened, they both felt that they would be completely isolated. So I think that's what kind of bound them or pushed them together at the end, was that they had really nowhere else to go to. If that makes sense.
Kind of, yeah.
Like there was no one really else to turn to. The French and the Russians. Because they were both kind of being kicked out and isolated. So I think that's how it happens. Also, you know, the Germans don't renew their non-aggression or their neutrality pact with Germany. So they're like, okay, they're not renewing the neutrality pact. They're favoring Austria, Hungary. There's a fear that our imperial rival could join an alliance with these central powers. I think we need to make an assurance and get into, you know, some type of deal with the French. We already have enough economic, interest with them. So why not make it official? I think we should wrap this up here because it is getting late here. I think we're almost a little bit over an hour and 15 minutes, and I think if we add anything else right now, it might get, I think we should save it because I want to give proper attention to some other aspects. Some follow-up episodes to this are, you know, one being the eventual, for people who are like, well, how did you talk about the British-German naval race that happens? Yeah, that's a huge part, and I don't want to go over that in like 20 minutes. So I think that will probably be either the next episode, and then I think it dive back into like the Serbian politics, the Balkans regions, and going in more depth there. But I mean, hopefully this can be kind of a series where we do causes of World War One, and we can kind of build from here and see what you all are interested in. But anything else, Danny?
Nope. If you like what you saw, or you want us to focus on a particular topic or surrounding the origins of World War One, let us know with a quick review. How about that?
Yeah, let us know if you want us to tackle something via review. You can do that on Apple iTunes, and you can also rate and review us on Spotify as well. Rating and reviewing the podcast is the number one way to support our show, so please do that. You can also join us on Patreon. That is another way you get access to our Slack community. And all right, let's wrap this thing up. Danny, anything else before we conclude?
No, man.
All right. Peace, guys.
Peace.
As a longtime foreign correspondent, I've worked in lots of places, but nowhere as important to the world as China. I'm Jane Perlez, former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. Join me on my new podcast, Face Off, U.S. versus China, where I'll take you behind the scenes in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. Find Face Off wherever you get your podcasts.